It's 12:06 and time for Artcentric Midday Matters here on WBOI. We'd love for you to be a part of today's conversation, so make sure you give us a call with any comments or questions, 260-452-1185. You can always post on our Facebook page or send us a note at middaymatters@nipr.fm. I'm Sarah D'Elia, and I'm joined by my lovely partner in crime, Julia Meek.
Hello, Sarah, and thank you. And today it is the building blocks of Artcentricity we're assembling in a larger-than-life way, I might say, beginning with a discussion of Sarah Blythe Stevens' wonderful plaster sculpture installation at the Allen County Public Library's lovely Kroll Gallery, with gallery librarian Amy Griffith joining us here in the studio, and Sarah by phone. And in our second segment, it's the Friends of the Parks of Allen County's symposium, The Wealth We Hold in Common, Landscape and Urban Design, that we're going to be learning about with their president and founder, Julie Donnell, in the studio, and one of the symposium lecturers, Alexander Garvin, on the phone line. But first, as we love to do, Sarah and I each have a quick pick art tip for you, a sparkling gem among the treasure trove of Artcentricities happening this week you really might want to consider. What's your pick, Sarah?
I'm picking the first of a series of shows by the Sweetwater Jazz Project beginning this Wednesday. They're performing at C2G, and every third Wednesday evening, 7 to 9:30 p.m. through April, and when they're performing at the New York City Jazz Festival at Lincoln Center. That's really exciting.
Most exciting.
Admission is $5 each night, and all the proceeds go towards their funds to raising for that trip. So that's this Wednesday at C2G Music Hall, 7 to 9:30, and it is some wicked good Sweetwater jazz, and it's a multi-high school ensemble, so enjoy them and support them.
I think that's great, and they are a great group and make wonderful music, and so keeping in the wicked good theme, I'm choosing a doubly wicked good show that's happening tonight featuring the End Time Spasm Band and Left Lane Cruiser. Talk about a stage full of sound. That's tonight at the Corner Pocket, 3215 St. Joe Center Road. It starts around 9, and there's no cover. And red hot music from End Time Spasm Band and Left Lane Cruiser. How could you ask for more?
You couldn't. You just couldn't.
No, we wouldn't need to. And now it is indeed a pleasure to introduce Fort Wayne artist Sarah Blythe Stevens joining us by telephone, and Kroll Gallery librarian Amy Griffin here in the studio with us, ready to discuss Sarah's brilliant plaster sculpture installation project, Almost Something. Hello, Amy.
Hi, Julia.
And hello, Sarah.
Hi there.
It's wonderful to talk to you by phone, Sarah, and sorry we missed the actual installation, but I would ask you and your trusty assistant here in the studio, Amy Griffin, to tell us about this, about a plaster installation, what that involves, what it is.
Well, it's a lot of plaster. this particular plaster installation was sort of instigated through actually my mom and Amy. It pretty much involves me. I mean, you can see in the video, you know, I just essentially throw a lot of plaster at plastic and it sets up and I take the plastic down. But it's a very messy affair, as Amy got to experience daily. It cleans up kind of nicely, I think.
Mm-hmm. And that time-lapse video is posted on our Facebook page, so if you want to have more of a visual and see Sarah's process for the plaster installation, you can go to Midday Matters, like us, and see that. It's a really interesting process. Tell us a little bit about how long it took you to complete the whole installation.
Well, it was 2 weeks total. The wall piece, the bigger one, that was the first week. Mm-hmm. Mainly I do that just because it happens that sometimes the walls do fail for whatever reason, and so I need time to be able to remake them because they are somewhat fragile. But so that first week was just devoted towards getting the opened the wall pieces up, and the second week was clean up and doing the other two pieces in the gallery. So it does take quite a bit of time mm-hmm. in the actual gallery.
Mm-hmm. We know that the Kroll Gallery is has become known for introducing so much interesting art to the area, and we thank you so much for that. Now, this is a unique sculpture installation in two ways, because it is, number one, it was done right there, right, Amy?
Yeah.
And then number two, it is a three-dimensional piece. If one can picture, Sarah did a really good job of describing a sheet of plastic to start things off, and then applying plaster, which, yes, folks, it is the kind of plaster that is somewhere in your life. It might be on the wall surfaces and, you know, the plaster castings that people made. In this case, it's quite a wet mixture, and you begin applying it to the sheet of plastic in interesting manners and patterns. And quite literally, like she says, when it's dry, then that plastic's removed. And so you have the thinnest, most delicate, fragile, beautiful, organic type shell of a sculpture left. whatever was not plastic or fallen to the ground is now standing there, and it's beautiful, a plaster
right.
sculpture.
Yeah.
So how did you develop such a technique, Sarah, especially with your the various other media that you like to use? When in your artistic career did you begin working with plaster in this manner?
That actually started, I finished my MFA at University of Cincinnati in 2010,
mm-hmm.
and it was during that time that I was there that I was able to sort of play with plaster in this way. That wall piece was actually at the end of my 2 years there at University of Cincinnati. It was slow progression. It's not a very obvious process to do. It's like, oh, well, I should just do this. It came out of my working with balloons and plaster, actually. I was interested in what it would be to cast balloons because of when the balloons obviously deflate, you know, what you have left, that sort of concavity and the remains or that sort of telling of what used to be there. Through that process, I just started noticing the way plaster behaved. And just sort of paid attention to little nuances that started happening. And, it moved, I don't know if, the sort of pedestal-like plaster pieces that are in that gallery that are smaller scale and squarish, those actually sort of came next, and then out of that it just sort of moved to the plastic piece, the giant wall pieces. It definitely was a very slow progression, but I think it speaks a lot to how my process works, which is essentially just go in the studio and just play, you know, with my materials and really just pay attention to how things are progress.
And watching you work, Sarah, in the gallery and hearing you talk about it right now reminds me of something that another sculptor that a lot of us know today working, Anish Kapoor, he said, reinvesting in one's own little moments of insight is so important. and I love that because I see that in your work, and I see that, and I'm just so excited to see what you do next, because all of those little moments of insight that you have created these amazing pieces, and you've shared it with our city, which is incredible.
Indeed.
Oh, thank you. It's funny you say that. Actually, I really love Anish Kapoor's work. He's great.
Great artist. Yeah, and he's always talking about how sculpture should occupy the same space that your body occupies. And that's something that you've also created for us in this space with the big wall piece, is that As soon as it's actually roped off right now, I'm sorry to tell you, until the trolley tour, we're a stop on the trolley tour next Friday. And starting that night, the ropes will be gone. People will be able to come and enter the space, and it will occupy the same space as your body. And I know that's really what you want and how the piece is intended.
Yeah, I mean, it is. The walls are fragile. They're more fragile in the beginning when they're setting up. And so, you know, I understand why the library wants to keep it in one piece, at least to the gallery or the trolley thing. But I'm kind of intrigued by that notion that something it's very vulnerable to the viewer. And I like that, you know, I don't know if most viewers realize at the end of the show, I'll just actually tear it down and throw it away. Mm-hmm. So at the end, it just stops being essentially. And I find it that sort of interaction with the person that goes in there. I think people are almost instantly aware that it is very fragile too, that maybe it's the thinness of it and the light going through, but, to slow people down when they go through it. I'll be excited when people get to actually go in and experience it.
The people that I've come into contact with lately in the gallery have said things like, I'm afraid to breathe near it. But you know, I assured them, I said, well, the one person that knows this sculpture's strength is the artist, and she wants people to move through it. But right now it's interesting to view from behind the ropes and also from the street. Right outside the gallery, we have wonderful windows into the library, and at all hours of the day, it changes because of the light and all the folds and the drapings. And it's almost like, you know, very thin cross section of mountains or volcanoes or
whatever. It is a slice. Yes, that's an interesting way to describe it. Not that there's any perfect way to describe it. I say we have a wonderful video on our Facebook page, Midday Matters Facebook page, that you can at least get a little taste for this. But obviously the best way to experience it would be go down to the library and experience it. And, you know, something that we were talking about before the show started, obviously this is the first time that there's ever been a plaster piece like this, this kind of an installation done in the Kroll Gallery. Mm-hmm. I was comparing it to the temporary or, you know, just here today, gone tomorrow, aspects of like sand and chalk painting, which is a two-dimensional, and yet it has that same purpose. But I will ask, actually, Sarah, you as an artist and Amy, you as the librarian at the gallery, how do people react? The frailty or the temporary nature of this very art piece, how does that move the viewers of the art? You know, when it really does dawn on them that this is temporary and meant to be so, what kind of an impact does that have on the art, on the observers?
I'm not really sure. Honestly, a lot of people talk to me. A lot of people really think that the first question people ask is, "How did you move this in here?"
How are you going to move it out of here?
Yeah. I don't think some people are even really aware that it was built on site, and I think that's more intriguing to them. I've never heard anybody. I've never really heard anybody be, I don't know, outraged or sad or anything, but I think mainly it's just that people don't know that it will be, you know, at all. I think some people go in, walk around, and not even be aware that it won't survive.
And I've been asked where it's going next and all of those things like that. And
dust to dust.
Yeah. And, I actually can't tell you where it will go next. But it is a piece like this, because there isn't necessarily words to describe it. You know, we say things like, I've heard people talk about clouds and mountains or other anthropomorphic things, but really it's about making a subconscious connection, because it is installation art, it is sculpture, but it's also connected to abstract art.
Indeed.
In that way. With the exception of one piece that's it's a smaller piece that Sarah's made with these very tall, thin balloons and plaster. And that is one piece in the gallery that people can look at and say, that's a balloon. I know what that is. But
yeah.
But it is decomposing as we speak. There are little shards of plaster on the gallery floor that are to remain there because these balloons are slowly deflating. So it's very exciting to watch those in the gallery right now.
So it seems to be alive because in a way it's alive. It's moving, it's changing. It's
somewhat decomposing. It's those aesthetics of like ruination that we're drawn to, but it's done in this beautiful pure white plaster that it creates a totally different experience for the viewer.
So what's next for you, Sarah?
Well, obviously just go back to the studio for a while and keep playing. I'm also involved with a gallery here in Cincinnati it's called MGGM, and we're actually they've been around Cincinnati for a few years, and they're having their last show in October, and so we're working on making that happen, and then once that's done, I think it's just a matter of just sort of working and playing and doing the artist life of applying shows and that stuff. But outside of that, it's just a normal work-a-day.
Nine-to-five
job.
I find it hard to believe that even you in a nine-to-five job, it would just be a normal work-day just with your creativity. Also, to note, you come from a very art-centric family. I know that, and your sister is gifted in so many musically and art-inclined ways, and your mother, Kathy Blythe, is an artist, a wonderful artist. She tends to be in the textiles and in a painting and other two-dimensional things like that. But how do they react to your boldness in this temporary format that you have embraced?
You know, they always say they love it, as families do. I think that, you know, my parents, both my dad and my mom have always been very supportive of my choice to go into the arts, which actually was a later choice in my life than you might think. But I'm sure both of them would hope one day that I decide to make work that actually remains intact. It's hard to make a living on stuff you throw in the trash. But anyway, that's another side there. You know, my family, I do have a lot of people in my family that are very creative in their own ways, and aunts and uncles, and, you know, I even have an uncle there in Fort Wayne. His name is Paul Stevens, and he's a really great musician there.
Yeah, just, indeed, yes.
Yeah, and I'm just very fortunate to have a very supportive, loving family. I think maybe even because of that, there really isn't a pressure for me to be like, or you must succeed and whatever, that I can, it creates an atmosphere where I can make something that doesn't have to last forever, can sort of just be for a moment. And that's sort of a refreshing feeling, I think, as an artist, to know that it doesn't have to be stay forever. It's almost, it really does let you do more just by not having to worry about it staying around forever, oddly enough.
Well, you do seize the moment, literally, with your with your art, and then you seize the imagination, I think, as well, too. And that's something that... Well, you've hit on maybe a secret or certainly an eccentric format to share something like that. Yes, it is bold and impactful, and then it's gone. And that's part of the mystique of it, I think.
Yeah, Yeah, I think it works almost better that way, that, you know, you get this moment with it, and then, and that's a really lovely moment, and then it's okay that it goes away.
Well, we have just a few minutes to recap and let folks know. Once again, we'll tell you, you can see examples of this fantastic kind of work by Sarah Blythe Stevens on our own Facebook page, and in a time-lapse little video of such plaster sculpture installation. And Amy, tell us exactly the hours and how folks can find it at the Allen County Public Library.
It's the Jeffrey Kroll Gallery is located at the main library downtown. We're right across from the children's department. So those familiar with the main floor of the public library, there's a giant globe that slowly spins. We're right across from there. This exhibition's a little different in that the doors are closed, but they're unlocked. And so you can walk in and experience we've sectioned the gallery off into two parts, where the first section is more of an educational section. And then the second half of the gallery is clearly where the work is. And the gallery is always open when the library is open.
And in this case, they are able to actually see that time-lapse video at the gallery, so that they can see how this piece was made.
Exactly. And as you enter, you'll also see a few still photos of the installation process, as well as a section where you can feel the materials, because these pieces are just begging to be touched.
Indeed. But,
so,
and plaster is such a tactilely refreshing thing to touch anyway.
It is refreshing, and it's also just incredible how thin it is, and then the different sounds that the plaster can make. It's almost like tin, but then sometimes it's just so sturdy. So there's a section up in the front part of the gallery where you can experience these materials, and then you can go experience the artwork. So
actually, this is a precious exhibit, because it's three parts. You've got the hands-on part of it, just mm-hmm. to get used to the medium, and then you've got the whole installation itself, mm-hmm. which is gorgeous, and you have the video, so that you can see how things were and are made in this case. And so it's really an experience and a totally self-guided and self-explanatory journey, I think, of
exactly
almost something. I think, Sarah, that you are quite something.
Oh, thank you.
And we wish you all the best and all the luck, and ask you to promise to keep us posted on where you'll be doing other installations like this, as well as whatever other art-centric endeavors that you choose. And also, thank you so much again. This is, we regard this as a gift that you've given to Fort Wayne, because I know you took your own time and trouble to come and do this and share it with us. And so,
well, it's a pleasure. It's always a pleasure to share. And I really thank the library there for allowing me. It's a beautiful space. And Amy was so wonderful in everything she did for us. So it was a pleasure.
Yeah, and we hope that the other artists realize that the library is a place for doing. We have this beautiful space in the gallery that's open to the public. And, you know, no money is attached to it. And we're so thankful that you could share with us, Sarah.
Oh, it was a pleasure.
All right, and we're unfortunately going to have to say goodbye to Amy and Sarah on this half of Artcentric Midday Matters. Julia and I will be back in just a few moments after this short news break. Support for WBOY is provided by Travel Leaders, proud supporter of public broadcasting featuring Alaskan cruises and European holidays. Travel Leaders, making vacations monumental, online at travelbetterindiana.com. And Reinbold and Anderson, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc. Member FINRA and SIPC. Plan to retire on your terms. More information at Reinbold and Anderson on NIPR's homepage, www.nipr.fm. We'll be back in just a few moments with more Artcentric Midday Matters here on WBOI.
Our Are you working for the weekend? Plug into the Friday Vibe. I'm Bill Forsyth, playing jazz of all types from all eras, plus blues, a little pop, folk, and rock to roll you into the weekend. The Friday Vibe, 7 to 11 on your home for jazz in Northeast Indiana, WBOI.
Good afternoon. I'm Sean Beter with WBOI News. Governor Mitch Daniels has named a Tippecanoe County judge as the first woman on the Indiana Supreme Court in 13 years. Daniels announced the appointment of Loretta Rush today at the State House. Rush is the first female justice since Myra Selby stepped down in 1999 after 5 years on the court. She's the third justice Daniels has appointed to the five-member court in the past 2 years. She replaces Justice Frank Sullivan, who stepped down after 19 years on the court. The 54-year-old Pennsylvania native says she puts an emphasis on the needs of children. In 1998, she survived an attack by a former juvenile client who invaded her home and tried to kill her husband. Brain injury advocates say the effects of those injuries are still too misunderstood by the public. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports, a weekend conference in Indiana aims to educate people about how brain injuries can strike anyone at any time.
Around 2 million people sustain brain injuries each year in the U.S., but only around 1.7 million seek treatment. Brain Injury Association of America President Susan Connors says those who don't try to get treatment are often unaware they're in trouble.
They just find that they are perhaps a little dazed, confused, maybe forgetful. It's not until their life spirals negatively that they say, oh, I need some medical attention here.
Dan Chamberlain is the chairman-elect of the Brain Injury Association of America and a board member of the Indiana chapter, the first state-chartered affiliate of the BIAA. He says Indiana is at the forefront of recognizing and treating brain injuries. The state has a network of 19 support groups, and legislation passed last session by the General Assembly regulates concussion management for young athletes.
When kids get injured playing soccer or football or whatever they're doing, there's now an analysis and a recognition that someone has been injured and a course of management to address those issues.
Chamberlain says the increased attention to brain injuries by the NFL and the military have helped jumpstart discussion about the severity of the problems. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith.
The Fort Wayne Tin Caps down one game to none, trying to even the championship series yesterday afternoon in Wisconsin. WBOY's Doug Gruber has more.
Home runs got the Tin Caps even with the Timber Rattlers at one game apiece. Fort Wayne took a 1-0 lead in the second inning on Lee Orr's home run to left center field. Wisconsin answered with their own home run in the fourth to even the score 1-1. Fort Wayne again took the lead in the fifth inning when Kyle Goodell led off with a double. Tyler Stubblefield then double-scoring Goodell. Stubblefield then scored on a Jace Peterson sacrifice fly, and the Tin Caps were up 3-1. Fort Wayne increased their lead in the ninth inning. Austin Hedges tripled, Dwanell Jones homered, and Fort Wayne had a 5-1 win. Tin Caps starting pitcher Colin Ray went 7 innings, allowing just 2 hits and 1 run. Johnny Barbato and Matt Stites shut down Wisconsin in the final 2 innings. So the best-of-5 series is now tied at 1 game apiece. Today is a day off as the teams travel to Fort Wayne. Game 3, tomorrow night at Parkview Field, first pitch 7:05. Game 4 will be Sunday at 5:05. For WBOI News, I'm Doug Gruber.
Taking a quick look at the WBOI weather forecast, expecting mostly sunny skies for the rest of the day. We'll have a high near 71 degrees. Overnight clear skies with a low around 45, and more sunshine on Saturday. We'll have a high near 74. You're listening to Midday Matters Arts-Centric here on 89.1 FM. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Friday Art-Centric Midday Matters here on WBOI. The time is 12:35. If you have a question or a comment, join the conversation by giving us a call at 260-452-1185. You can always send us a note at middaymatters@nipr.fm or post on our Facebook page. I'm Sarah D'Elia, and I'm joined by Julia Meek, my co-host, and we're going to be changing gears a little bit in the same vein, but different topic.
You've guessed correctly. What we're doing is trading one of the most fragile of building elements in the entire universe, which would be a thin drip plaster, for the terra firmaist, I guess we could say. We welcome the Friends of the Allen County Parks founder and president, Julie Donnell, and by phone, author Alexander Garvin, ready to discuss the upcoming symposium, The Wealth We Hold in Common, Landscape and Urban Design. Welcome to both of you, and thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, indeed. Thank you.
We know that, well, actually, it's a wonderful annual affair to celebrate the parks and all that we hold dear and precious to us. And again, Julie, I do have to commend you and thank you from the bottom of my heart for forming such an organization. And now you have this wonderful symposium. Why don't you tell us, because it is, well, it's the 100th anniversary of George Kessler's Park and Boulevard Plan, in particular, that this symposium celebrates,
correct? We decided a couple of years ago that we wanted to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the Kessler Park and Boulevard Plan. And as we progressed in our thinking about the year, we started to realize that this wasn't about historic preservation. It was about a broader vision and American culture. Mm-hmm. And so we put together a very interesting group of people, and Alex, of course, is our first speaker. And Alex has written a fabulous, fabulous book called Public Parks, The Key to Livable Communities. And I have to tell you, my husband gave it to me for Christmas, and I was reading it, and I thought, I'm going to Google this guy. I'm going to find out about this guy. So I Googled and found out he was on the faculty at Yale, and I sent him an email, and I thought, well, when school starts again, I'll probably hear from Alex, and maybe he'd come to Fort Wayne. By golly, in 2 hours, I had an email, and he said he would love to come. And I thought, this is a fabulous guy. People who do parks work and urban planning work on this scale and thinking on this scale are so generous. So we are really fortunate to have Alex Garvin. We also have Steve Schuckman coming, who is the director of park planning for Cincinnati. And that has particular resonance with Fort Wayne because Cincinnati, of course, is on the rivers, and they have a George Kessler Park and Boulevard system. And then finally, we're also bringing in Greg Bleem, who worked for the preeminent landscape architect in America of the last century, Dan Kiley. And that's kind of it's not about parks, but it's about the landscape legacy. And we have a Dan Kiley landscape in Fort Wayne. And then finally, we're bringing in Eric Kuhn, who in the 70s rediscovered the Kessler Park and Boulevard system and did the design for Headwaters Park in Fort Wayne, which is, Kessler called for a central park, but Mayor Hosey took the land and put the water filtration plant on it. So Eric and Wynn Moses and many, many others reclaimed another spot in Fort Wayne for Headwaters Park. So we're just absolutely out of our minds about these speakers.
I think it's fantastic, and also it gives our own community a chance to really revel in the amazing park system that we do have. I know that one of the big selling points for bringing people, when people decide whether they would move to Fort Wayne or not, the school system, the park system, the all come up ranked so highly. And I'd ask Alexander, because you've studied all forms of the of urban planning and architecture, and you are into public service and all of that, why is the park system so important to the community?
The first thing is that it is the framework around which the entire community grows. And it makes no difference whether you're looking at a place like Boston, which has this emerald necklace that Frederick Law Olmsted designed in the 19th century that became the framework around which Boston grew, or whether you're talking about a city like Minneapolis, which went far further and created a system in which nobody is more than 6 blocks away from the park, and there are 22 lakes that you can go to and do almost anything you want. The second thing is, once you have this framework, that means that there are places for people to go out, to run, to bicycle, play ball. It's absolutely necessary in the 21st century to have places for recreation. Otherwise, we become sedentary and put on weight and have an extremely unhealthy population, which, of course, costs because we have then to pay for the health system that is required because we don't have a good enough park system. The third thing that I would say is there's a kind of well-being that comes along with this. I mean, people who go to a public park just feel better. Everybody knows that. And places like New York have experienced tremendous growth in real estate values around the parks. Now, it isn't any park that does that. It's got to be a good park, and it's got to be well taken care of. And one of our problems is that during the 1970s, we began to disinvest in them. The result is, as they went downhill, people didn't want to go there. They were afraid of them, and it attracted antisocial activity of one sort or another, and pretty soon it was having a negative impact. That's all being reversed slowly, especially by nonprofit parks organizations that are forming all over the country to take responsibility for parks that the budget of some local government is inadequate to provide services for.
And thank you. How would you say, of course, you've gotten to meet our illustrious founder and president, but how would you say our own Friends of the Parks of Allen County rates amongst those nonprofits groups that are determined to bring the parks to the forefront as they deserve to be?
I cannot answer the question because I will come for the first time to Fort Wayne a week from tomorrow, and I intend to spend my first day looking at it. And I never talk about places I have never been. I have, however, seen Kessler's park and parkway system for Kansas City, for Omaha, and for Memphis. Thus I can put it in some sort of context, and I own a copy of a plan Kessler did for Dallas at the beginning of the 20th century, in which he proposed something that became Turtle Creek Park, which is where most of the most desirable condominiums and large houses are now located in Dallas. So it isn't that I don't know about Kessler, it's that I've never been to Fort Wayne, and I can't tell you anything until I've had at least a day to look around.
Well, we will give you that, and really we can't wait. We love it, and we have our Three Rivers, and we have all the parks around them, and we love all of that. What are some of the other activities? I'm going to ask Julie now. What are some of the other activities that go with this two-day symposium?
There's a series of lectures on Monday, and Alex is the first lecturer. Mm-hmm. And then the day before, on Sunday, there's a tour. Eric Kuhn is going to lead a tour of Headwaters Park and talk about that context. There'll be also a tour of the Concordia Lutheran campus and a tour of Schoaf Park led by John Schoaf. And Schoaf Park, for those of you who don't know, was not designed by George Kessler, but it was designed by Arthur Shercliffe and might have been the last commission Arthur Shercliffe ever did. And so we're really fortunate to have several layers of landscape architecture in Fort Wayne, including Kessler, Arthur Shercliffe, and then our own Adolf Jenicke, who was head of the Parks Department for 38 years. So that's what that's about.
I know that part of it is that Fort Wayne was at the right time at the right place, and also a lot of the founding fathers really were thoughtful as well as visionary in understanding the importance of the parks. Also, no small part because we have the fairly unique Three Rivers situation. But a question actually for Alexandra as well as you, Julie. What drives, especially in the founding, which would be the key time when people are developing the parks or the park system, what drives a community to pay attention to that development?
Alex, do you want to take that or do you want me to start?
Well, I don't mind taking it because I think that each community is different and what occurs there will have a local character that will be different, but there are basic principles that are not going to go away. For example, we want to have a civil society. We want people to be able to interact together. Can you imagine that happening if mothers weren't sitting on benches watching small children in a playground? Now, that may sound to you like something innocuous. But that's where people learn to play together, to work together. The most amazing thing about what I am biased because I'm a New Yorker, the most successful park ever done by Frederica Olmsted and Calvert Vaux is Central Park, where I grew up. And if you go there, you will find on a typical weekend a 250,000 people all doing something else, nobody intruding on the other people who are doing things there, whether they're tossing a frisbee or riding a bicycle or rowing a boat or just sitting on a bench. That becomes the basis of a civil society. And it is increasingly important to the United States that we have that. And invariably, the communities that start want to have that sort of thing. They've got to create something that will survive, and will only survive if there is that sense of community.
And that's exactly what happened in Fort Wayne. You had civic leaders at the turn of the century who wanted to see that happen. My husband's grandfather was president of the park board for until the early 60s. And across America, you find a decline in the landscape architecture beginning about in 1949. But Fort Wayne was really fortunate because it had this continuity of leadership up until the early 60s. And that doesn't mean that we've done anything bad. In fact, we haven't. But budgets begin to contract. City budgets begin to contract about mid-century. And so that leadership continues to resurface over time. And that's what I particularly love the sections in Alex's book about stewardship and about keeping the parks alive and the private sector and that value added from the private sector, because that's so important in Fort Wayne and it's important everywhere we go.
But that stewardship is absolutely central, and invariably where we have independent parks boards or conservancies that have been established, they are the ones that are the watchdogs. They find the money to do things. It's really quite remarkable. I had an experience in Memphis with Shelby Farms Park. It's a 4,500-acre park within the city. True, it's on the eastern side. And it was operated by the county, and it had been a prison farm before it became a park. And when the Conservancy wanted to take it over, I said, "You're wasting your time." And they said, "Why?" I said, "Because the county provides $700,000 for this 4,500-acre park." And they said, "Well, we'll get them to spend more money." And I said, "I don't know many communities that want to raise taxes or fire teachers or policemen." And they sort of looked at me. I said, "You need a board." And they created one. They're raising millions, tens of millions of dollars already. They have more than 20 that they've spent fixing it up, changing the budget, because they want to have a place for the entire community to come. And this has been happening in Atlanta, in New York, all over. There are very few park systems that can survive simply on the leftovers of what the local government is going to spend.
Absolutely.
Wonderful point. I would like to remind our listeners that this is Midday Matters Friday Art-Centric, and we are very, very happy to be discussing the Friends of the Parks of Allen County's upcoming symposium with the founder of the Friends of the Parks and one of the speakers at the symposium, Alexander Garvin, and the lovely Julie Donnell, excuse me, getting ahead of myself and behind myself all at one time. If folks would like to call in, you may, a question or comment, 452-1185. And in the meantime, I have yet another one sitting here in public radio, which is successful after all these years because it became a Friends of, from going from a college station then to a community radio station. And again, I'm not just asking for a rehash of saying in yet another way that the friends of and the support groups and the local groups, you know, make the difference. But to both of you, your experience, what more could we do, and how can we grow our ranks?
I can be specific to Fort Wayne, and in that when we started the Friends of the Parks, we didn't know what we were doing. I'm a musician. I didn't intend to start the Friends of the Parks. It sort of happened to me. And what we didn't know at the time was that there were conservancies. And had we known that, we might not have been an advocacy group. However, we are an advocacy and education group, and we have a park foundation in Fort Wayne. But it's time now to rethink the old paradigm and to become more proactive, because we're not seeing the parks budget increase in Fort Wayne. We're seeing it contract. In fact, I think I have news that it may be contracting further. And that's a wake-up call to us to move from advocacy into more advanced fundraising. I do remember when I met with the Park Foundation the first time we founded the Friends, I sat very small in my chair, and one big tall man looked down at me and said, "You're not going to raise money, are you?" And I said, "Oh, no, I'm not going to raise money." So we've raised more than $500,000 for certain projects and so forth, and we're easing our way into that, but we need to become more proactive, and that's nothing wrong. It's just the process, as Alex said. Every community is different, and so that's kind of where we are in Fort Wayne. Mm-hmm. But we have to be honest about what's happening to the budget too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we actually have a caller. Mary is on line one. Mary, welcome to Midday Matters.
Well, good afternoon. I'm curious to know when, where, and how we can get access to this symposium. It sounds magnificent.
You can go to the Fort Wayne Parks Department website, www.fortwayneparks.org, and register online, or you can call 427-6000. That's 260-427-6000.
I'll also remind our listeners that we have the flyer, the information for the symposium on our Facebook page, Midday Matters, and you can find us that way, and we can get the information to you however we can, because this is such a wonderful, wonderful event. And Alexander, you are you're an educator and author, and so you've got so much going for you now. Do you spend a lot of your time touring the United States?
I do, and not only the United States, the world.
Okay. that was the next question.
I'm actually going down to look at a potential community in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida, in 2 weeks. That is the week after I'm in Fort Wayne, and then I'm taking off for a week to go to Prague in the middle of October. And this is while I'm teaching two courses at Yale and trying to do the third edition of The American City and run a small consulting company that I have.
So, my goodness.
yes, I do go around. I never talk about places I haven't been. And I also am very careful to try to go to see things, because they change all the time. What you think was there because you were there 20 years ago may no longer be there. I'll give you a live example, because I was talking before about the importance of a civil society. Every city, not just Fort Wayne or some other city in the United States, every city had budget cuts in the 1970s. New York nearly went bankrupt. To give you an idea, they of course, the first thing they cut is my profession, planning, followed by parks, invariably. And I used to be embarrassed, because on late night TV, on Johnny Carson, there used to be stories about muggings in Central Park. Well, let me tell you, in 1982, there were more than 1,000 felonies in a year in Central Park, including 9 murders. In 2011, there were 17 robberies and no murders. Because in the 30 years in between, we have been investing in fixing up the park. And when you have enough people in the park, they're the ones who keep criminal activity out of the park. And that's why this is so important.
Amen to that.
And that's
certainly I think that you're fortunate, and also you've done so much with it, Alexander, to have grown up and around New York City. Of course, they're lucky to have you there too. what might you say? What aspect of your job is your favorite? And I understand, or your jobs that is the favorite part of your life.
I'm blessed by having to learn from the smartest young people, in all of whom come to my classes at Yale, and they are so interesting and so capable. It is really quite extraordinary. That's my favorite thing. The other is I get to go out and look at all these places. I mean, I have wanted to see yet another Kessler Park system for years. I thought I had I would never again get to do it after I'd been in Omaha. Now I'm going to Fort Wayne. That gives you an idea of the kinds of wonderful things you can do. And I learn all the time. I was in Milwaukee last month, and looking at the Third Ward in Milwaukee, it's utterly fascinating how that community revived a lost district. They were clever in a way that many other cities are not. They figured out Americans drive everywhere, and lofts don't have parking places. Therefore, the city invested in building two parking garages, and that triggered the renovation of these perfectly wonderful old buildings that were sitting empty. And so I learned a lot by visiting Milwaukee.
Do you feel like you have the perfect, you sit in a perfect world too, I think, with urban planning and real estate and architecture, and then of course all the and the parkitecture as well. Was that a plan? I mean, did embracing one lead to having to see it all and know it all and embrace it all?
Well, yes. If you want to be a city planner, you're supposed to know about everything. Everybody expects you to have answers all the time, and since every community is different, you've got to be on your toes all the time, because you may see something that you've never seen before. I had to teach these extraordinary Yaleys. I've taught at Yale for 45 years. And I had to be able to convince my students of what I was saying. So I went out and I took pictures. And I have a image library of over 200,000 images on my computer. All over the world, everything from Seoul, Korea, now I will add Prague, where I have never been. The same thing was true when I worked in the city of New York. I have been in and out of 5 New York City governments in different jobs, including the rebuilding of the World Trade Center, which I left after we brought in the Libeskind Plan in 2003. And if you talk to any group of citizens that are exercised about anything, you've got to be able to tell them the truth, because they won't stand for anything else.
Well, thank you.
Just imagine what it was like after 9/11.
Indeed. And thank you so much. Unfortunately, we have to be leaving. We ask everybody to join us in the symposium.
Yes, please join us in the symposium. It's The Wealth We Hold in Common, Landscape and Urban Design. It will be in a week.
So we'll find out about it. And thank you, Alexander.
And this is Northeast Indiana Public Radio, broadcasting from the Matt Rothschild Studios at 89.1 HD Channel 1. We're streaming online at NIPR.FM. This is WBOY Fort Wayne. Julie and I will be back same time, same place next Friday at noon for more art-centric Midday Matters. It's 1 o'clock and Fresh Air is up next. From W.